too. I had to replace the that ferrite transformer in there once because it did fracture from overheating or something. But yeah, they are kind of delicate too.
Hey, is it a pill?
Yes, Jeff?
Yeah, thanks, Roy. R7 is a multi-band antenna. It's not half-wave on anything, or maybe only on one thing.
It's a high-impedance input, and they do have a high-impedance matching. They achieve half-wave by several traps on there. Without those, that matching box there, you wouldn't be able to operate.
PhD.
Yeah, Jim?
I all the commentary is very much welcome, but I want to bring it back and specify. I'm not talking about a multi-band, non-resident antenna that is very, very popular, very common, a lot of respect for the that whole concept. I'm talking about a resonant antenna, accurately half-wave, tuned to a specific frequency, in this case, very low. Let's just say 1.8 megahertz, 260 feet long, and fed, hard choked, very hard. And this whole thing about the counterpoise being the other half of the antenna, what I'm seeming to understand is that there is no other half of the antenna needed. The half wave is the whole antenna. You match the impedance. The other half of the antenna comes with a quarter wave antenna that needs the other half to create a half wave antenna. And it's interesting. There's lots of differing opinions on this. And I don't know, I'm certain we're not going to solve it, but I'm enjoying the discussion. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, Jim. Now, we've all been talking about the resonant, the half wave that you've been talking about. And it's my understanding that in the practical world, there is something working as a counterpoise. If you don't give an antenna a counterpoise, it tries to kind of take it from someplace, somewhere. And so, you know, as far as I'm aware, it might be negligible in length. You know, it might be an inch or 2 inches because you're not really ending the antenna at the physical boundaries of the wire. So there's something operating as a counterpoise. And that's my understanding. I could be completely wrong, but that's my understanding, and that's why a lot of other people's resident NFED half waves have something that they recognize as a counterpoise. It may be obvious, or it may be far less obvious, but they almost all do. And if you theoretically kind of cut it off, you know, without any chance of any counterpoise, that generally tends to undermine the design, as far as, again, I am aware. There's a lot of places where counterpoises can operate without being obvious counterpoises. And I think that's what's happening in effective NFED resonant half-wave antennas.
K2STP.
Yes, Chris.
Hi, Roy. Thanks. My experience, so I have a multi-band NFED half-wave antenna. I know that's not what he's asking about. However, I talked at length about this exact subject for mine with the engineer that built it. He's a very well-respected RF engineer that does nothing but build antennas. And I guess he's known as an expert, and his antennas are pretty good. I have a very noisy environment, and I was picking up a lot of noise. I still am, mainly because of a lot of equipment that I have in my home. But I was speaking at this exact subject with him to try to figure out ways I could get around it. And we talked about whether I had the counterpoise or not connected. I have a 49-to-1 on it, and there is a connection for a counterpoise / what he calls grounding position. So you can just hang a wire off it at different lengths and try it, or you can actually just run a ground wire down to a good ground at the ground from that from that counterpoise, quote-unquote, position, or connector, I should say, on the onion. And he, even as the engineer that designed this, says he has no idea which will work in any specific situation. As you always say, Roy, there's just so many different things that come into play. So his suggestion was try them all. Put a wire on it, hang it short, hang it long, try grounding it, and try it without it. And to be honest, I tried everything and nothing made a bit of difference. And it didn't matter if I choked it or not either going into the shack. But he did say one thing is you always want it really well grounded before it comes into the shack. So you want your coax to be grounded.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, NFED half waves are infamous for causing interference because they travel, unless you choke them, they travel down as common mode, radiating like the antennas that they are all the way into your shack if you don't choke them. So they're infamous for being troublesome for the ham and for his neighbors. So it's always a good idea to either ground it or choke it, but in some way limit the common mode radiation. You do not want antennas entering your house. You want them as far away from your house as you can get them to be.
Yeah, that is true, and he mentions that. And, you know, that's exactly what we talked about. But I've never had any of those problems, and it didn't really make a difference what I did. However, I do have, I'm basically on the beach, as you know, and I'm a very sandy environment, and there's salt water underneath me. So I have really good grounding, and I have grounding at the base of the antenna, and then I have a second one before it enters my shack, and they're real deep rods into the sand and salt water. So my grounding is really well, and I don't have any problem. I do have a high noise level, but that's mainly from a lot of equipment that I have in the house. But he told me that's the most important thing with this antenna, and the rest of it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. He just said try it. The only way to check it is try it. And FYI, Roy, you were mentioning there's another piece of the counterpoise. He did say, I have 60 feet of feed line of coax, and he said that will work as the counterpoise. So it probably won't make a bit of difference off my onion, and he was exactly right.
Yeah, as long as you don't excessively RF choke it. You know, physics will find a way. Just because you have this, not you, but anyone has this thing about counterpoises, if the laws of physics can use some element in your antenna system as a counterpoise, it will. And, you know, fortunately, either because your equipment is well shielded or out of sheer luck, you don't have problems. You know, it depends upon how much power I use. If I go full power, you know, I have the antennas on the roof, and they've been known to twiddle with some accessory piece of equipment. I had problems with my LP 500 watt meter until I moved it to another computer. The USB connection, for some odd reason, was picking up RF noise and crashing that watt meter. But when I swapped it to another computer, it worked fine. But, yeah, you have to trial and error these things, unfortunately. And sometimes the results defy antenna theory. And you just have to live with it, I'm afraid.
KE2GOG.
Yes, what can I do you for?
What about choking the ground in his case? Because he has such great ground. What if he's... things that, you know, the signal's coming back to him as noise that way. Is that far-fetched?
Yeah, the idea of a good ground is it kind of soaks up any excessive RF. So once you've touched a good ground, because there's a lot of crappy ground out there, you know, a lot of granite, a lot of stone. This is all just silt and sand and salt water. Then that should be it. You should, you know, I mean, I'm a believer in the belt suspenders, but this is probably more a case of belt suspenders and staple gun.
DC?
Yes, Rich?
As you know, I've been getting into, excuse me, one second. Getting into a lot of portable work and with NFED half waves. And I read about one design which I've tried, which has turned out to be fabulous for me, and that is you choke the coax 10 feet from the un-un, and it doesn't matter how long it is from there to the rig, but so I put a whole bunch of beads, ferrite beads, 10 feet from the un-un, and then ran the rest of the coax to the rig, and it works just great. It's been a fabulous antenna for me. Go ahead.
KC2GS. Well, yeah, that 10 feet is the magic number for you for these. But there are other guys in other places where 10 feet might not be right. For some of them, they may need to think more of 4 or 5 feet. Others, 20 feet. Again, you can't kind of set any of this stuff in stone as much as we all would like to, because it would make life much easier for all of us. There are so many secondary aspects to antenna systems that we don't take into account that ultimately you can pick one of the things that helps a lot of people and see if it works for you, but be prepared to kind of modify that based on your own results.
I don't understand why the length of a counterpoise isn't like the length of a radial. You know, where you have a quarter wave length, a half wave length for the radials. Why doesn't that apply to counterpoises?
Because it doesn't really apply to radials either. It depends, you know, you had, I think it was John mentioned his antenna, in which he has radials, but they're very short because they're operating as radials / counterpoises to a half-wave resonant antenna. So, again, we went through this when we discussed radials, that although you'll get probably more than 50% of people telling you that your radials should be a quarter wavelength long, you will get all kinds of other answers from people who use those other answers and are extremely happy with the way that their antenna works. So radials is not exactly a quarter wavelength for everyone. Again, it depends on the type of antenna especially, and then it depends on the other factors surrounding the installation of that antenna at that site.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
ID, this is Jim, KD2VHD. So a lot of times this type of conversation talks about the other half of the antenna, the counterpoise, the radials, the other leg of the dipole. But I'm coming to understand, but I don't truly understand. But it seems to be what I'm understanding from what I've learned. Is that a half-wave antenna doesn't need another half. It's a complete antenna on its own. It doesn't need a counterpoise or a radial or a, you know, the other leg of the dipole. It is its own complete antenna. Now, I know in reality it's not quite that simple, but there's lots of examples of that being the case. Like I said, the marine antenna is one of them. And I think it's clear. I don't fully understand this, but I'm trying.
Okay, I will give you something to chew on. John, KD2BD, the gentleman I just mentioned earlier, he lives in New Jersey. He can't really get into the repeater, but he listens to the audio stream and he writes on the chat room. He said, no, the NFED half-wave is not the whole antenna. You can't get current to flow through an open circuit. So there's something else going on in the surroundings of an NFED half-wave that operate as a counterpoise. I agree with John. And although, you know, it's I've heard people describe NFED half waves as just kind of one-sided operations. Usually, again, they're kind of using theoretical physics, which is very nice, but not in the real world. that there's a little bit more to the end fed than just the end fed.
This is
the pimp.
Yes.
All right. With respect to the other kind of non-existent half of the antenna, let's think for a second about the, virtual half of the antenna, which is into the ground for a vertical, for example.
Okay.
I mean, that's in every textbook, and every one of us has read it, so I don't understand why people are missing that concept.
Well, everyone's read it. Some people don't remember it. Some people were vaguely confused about virtual versus real and such, so I could understand that. A lot of people, they took that test a long time ago, and there are some things that are a little foggy.
Yeah, you know, another thing on this, it makes a big difference as the height of the antenna along the ground.
Yeah, I've mentioned it. The elevation, the distortions from a straight line, the environment, whether there are hills or valleys, whether there are buildings, whether there are metal signs, all kinds of things factor in, especially in the near field.
This is AD2KJ. May I join the net?
Certainly.
My name is Bruce, AD2KJ. I live in Northport, and I've been listening a little bit to the conversation, and I'm finding it quite fascinating. I have some opinions on it, but I will reserve them until it's an appropriate time. Someone would like me to explain like my experience with that, but I'll hold off for a bit. I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm relatively new as a ham. I got my license in April, and I'm a crazy guy. I went right for the extra class in one shot, but I'm an electrical engineer, so I got a little bit of a head start. Anyway, I'll turn it back to Ned and just wait until you maybe call me back.
Okay, Bruce, glad to have another person aboard. I did the same thing, and I'm not an electrical engineer. I'm a physician by training, but I did the exact same thing because the guys who were going to test me, the VE guys, kind of chickened out, and they said that they didn't want to get together three of them for just me because no one else was scheduled for the VE session. So I took it up in Yonkers, who are a wonderful bunch of guys, but I kind of left such a bad taste in my mouth. I wanted to kind of run to home base and be done with it, so I didn't have to have guys canceling my VE test. So congratulations, Bruce.
Thank you. I gather your name is Roy, from what I've heard. Yeah, congratulations to you, too, I guess.
Yes, I am Roy, AC2GS. But thank you, Bruce. If I forget you, God forbid, feel free to kind of shout out and remind me that you have some things to say on this subject, okay?
Absolutely. I mean, I could probably give you a very intuitive way of looking at the NFED antenna. When the impedance goes high, the voltage goes high, too, right? That's the whole point of that 49 to 1 or 64 to 1 that you're kind of connecting to that. When you're looking at a balanced antenna, like a center-fed dipole, you don't need to account for it because all the energy is balanced in both directions. But you probably need a counterpoise on an end-fed because how do you push that current? Even though the current is lower and the voltage is much higher, you still need some way of, if I say torque or leverage, it's kind of just to visualize. It's something to push against. That's the easiest way to kind of maybe visualize it. I'll get back to you. Sorry.
Okay, one second. I usually kind of pull out my little seesaw story, which is, imagine a seesaw. Imagine someone sawing the middle of the seesaw, and how are you going to use that seesaw from that point on? YDY, what do you want to
hear Bruce's description. Let me see if
I got it. N1 Whitey White?
Yep.
Okay, I don't know the physics of it or the theory of it, but I can tell you that when you hook up a VHF marine radio, most of the time they give you half-wave infeds because you don't have a place to get a balanced antenna. So when you mount one of these things, specifically something like a Metz or a Gertz, which are the very popular ones, and you mount one of these things on a small fiberglass boat that has no end feed or counterpoise. The only thing they've got is the shield of a coax, and they seem to get out well, and they seem to have low SWR, which we both know doesn't mean much, but, you know, they're the standard for a VHF radio on a small boat, or actually a number of sailboats. Now, when you get into a sailboat, you put that same antenna on top of a 35 or 45-foot aluminum mast, you get the benefit, of course, of elevation, but it also seems to get out better for the radio. So I guess they, as this guy was saying, you're pushing against the mast, but it does seem to work better when it's mounted onto a large aluminum stick.
Yeah, I mean, once again, you know, physics finds a way. If you give it any opportunity to use anything as a counterpoise, if it doesn't violate the laws of physics, it will. You know, the outer jacket of a coaxial cable will operate as a counterpoise just as well as anything else.
Easy.
Okay,
yeah, Rich.
Thank you.
The way I construct my NFED half-wave in the field, portable work, is I have a 25-foot telescoping whip, and I just attach the end of the 66-foot long wire. I attach it to the top of the whip, and then I run it. And to keep it off the ground, completely off the ground, I usually run the wire over my car and to a fence stake, which has the 49-to-1 on the top of it. So there's no wire touching the ground from the top of the whip to the 49-to-1 transformer. I'm wondering, though, by running it across my car, can I be doing some ill to the antenna because of coupling it to the metal of the car, do you think? Go ahead.
Well, most likely it is having some kind of an effect. Although I tend to think people believe that cars are kind of shielded, like they're just boxes. In point of fact, the outer shell is a conductor, and the tires are conductive. There's carbon black in them, not only to make them black, but to act as a conductor for ground. So they're part of a circuit to ground, so they're going to have an effect of some kind.
Yeah, I've just been wondering if it's better to keep that wire off the ground or off the top of the car. Don't know. And it's really too hard to tell in the field if there's any difference at all. The only thing about my NFED half-wave that I don't like is, you know how if you do an SWR sweep with an NFED half-wave, you'll see dips at the different bands. I see that, but the dips are all at 3-to-1 or better or higher on my SWR analyzer. I don't know why it's that high, but it's showing the exact same picture except two SWR units higher than I would like it to.
It may be an effect of whatever your antenna is using as a counterpoise. It's difficult to say. Again, it's trial and error, unfortunately. There are an infinite number of permutations of how to configure these antennas, and no one has the life expectancy to try everyone, but you pick a couple of easy ones to kind of try and see what works best for you, and then stick with that or tweak it even further. So, you know, a lot of things have a lot of effects on a lot of aspects of NFEST. Just be thankful that the valleys coincide with the ham bands. There are NFEDs that kind of slide right out of the ham bands as they go up in frequency.
K2SDP.
Yes, Chris.
So, Rich, I have a suggestion for you with that antenna to try. It's pretty easy to try. Next time you're out in the field, bring a ground rod with you, any kind of metal rod, 3 or 6 feet long. Hammer it into the ground wherever you are, and take your counterpoise wire and connect, ground it right to that rod and see if that makes a difference. Because that's what my engineer said to try, which I did, but nothing really made any difference for me. That's something for you to try.
Not a bad idea. I have these fence posts that I could try that with too, but they're not ground rods. I have a ground rod I could take out in the field the next time, except I don't know how I would attach it to the coax coming off of the 49-1. How would you attach that to the ground rod? Go ahead.
Well, most of the onions have a ground connector to it that I've seen. If you don't, you could add one, I guess. But to the ground rod, I mean, you can use a copper pipe or something, drill a hole in it and put a screw on it and wrap the wire around it. I mean, any way to attach it. A little clamp. They sell the clamp at Home Depot to attach to an actual copper ground rod if you have one. Just clamp it, or even use a little pipe clamp and just clamp the wire to the pipe or rod, whatever you use.
Unfortunately, my 49-1 does not have a separate ground lug on it, so I can't do that. There really would be no other way to attach it to the ground rod if I just have a coax connector on the 49-1. Go ahead.
You could connect it to the outer ring of the SO239.
That's a possibility.
AC2GS, any other comments on this particular subject?
KE2GOG, I guess he's just going to have to report back after he connects to the outer shell of the coax connector.
AC2PL.
Yes, Jeff.
I think, you know, the comment, well, at least it was made briefly, I think you said it, the comment near field is one thing that a lot of us don't appreciate. What happens in the near field is that the RF order radiating interacts with everything. I've been doing experimentation with a mag loop, and this was years ago in my shack, and I happened to have another mag loop nearby that was not connected to anything, which had a little neon tube connected to it, and it was tuned to roughly the same frequency. And when I keyed it up to tune up the one that was attached to the radio, as you would expect, the neon tube in the other antenna that wasn't connected to anything lit up like a Christmas tree. So the RF that we're generating in our near field interacts with everything. So yeah, the real lobe and the imaginary lobe definitely interact with things that we don't really anticipate that they will. Go ahead.
Yes, indeed. I find the near field to be fascinating. And confusing as heck. I mean, I don't feel quite that bad because even Dick, may he rest in peace, was confused by many aspects. One being that electromagnetic waves in the near field have a different phase relationship. A part of the electromagnetic waves are not in phase but in quadrature phase, which doesn't make any sense. How they get from quadrature to in phase as they get past the near field into the far field. And Dick didn't quite know how to explain it, and I certainly didn't know how to explain it. And I mentioned a few times that a guy actually spent a couple of years on his doctoral thesis to try and explain it. And I read his thesis, and I'm not quite sure if people agree with him or not. You know, it was a reasonable theory. So, you know, if any of you guys have time to waste or are interested in tempting fate with your brains blowing up, really, you know, look deeply into the field of near field. It's a very, very strange phenomena that hams don't really think too much about, because we're too busy worrying about far field effects.
PhD.
Yes, Jim?
I have not heard near field effects mentioned since Andy's passing. I miss Andy. He was an amazing element of this whole thing we do. I never heard of it, near field stuff, until I heard it from him. So good point, Troy, and a hat tip to Andy.
Yes, indeed. May he rest in peace. He will be remembered, and he will be missed. And, you know, if anything, I wish he had the sense of how dear he was to all of us. You know, I told Andy that when he kind of was a little anxious about his Andy's Corner, that he could sit there and read the telephone directory, and we'd all listen and be very happy.
But he always brought more to the table than that, that's for certain.
Absolutely. Anyone else with any comment to this particular subject, please hit that push to talk.
Thank you for humoring me on this topic. Back to that, Roy.
No problem,
KJ.
Yeah, Bruce.
Well, I'm in a kind of strange situation. I don't have any antennas that are actually outside. Everything is in my attic. So, by definition, everything has to be balanced. So I have, this sounds a little nuts, I have, my ham shack is on the second floor, and my antennas are in the attic. And I have six runs of LMR 400. Going up to three open stuff J poles for the UHF and VHF stuff, and then multi connected, I guess, fan type dipoles running in across the whole length of the attic, you know, on the long side, and then even running in a inverted V on the across the eaves. And I'm getting out to New Zealand with 100 watts. It's crazy. But everything is resonant. I do not have an antenna tuner whatsoever. And in some cases, like the ones that are, you know, like my 3.80 meter, you know, antenna up there is, it's such a narrow bandwidth because it's, you know, a central loaded with tons of coils on it. But I only get on there at one or two little frequencies, and the SWR is reasonable. Everything is under 1.5, except if I go off frequency on the 80, and I barely use it. I'm almost always on 20, and I guess 40. That would be the two main ones on the HF area, and then yes, the 2 meter and 70 centimeter stuff. And that's the story here. It would really be nice to be able to put up a big antenna, but I'm not too flexible anymore. So for me, it's like much easier to maintain these things going up one little flight of steps. 82KJ, back to Ned. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. Well, you know, whatever works for us works. Everyone would love to have an antenna farm, but no one in this area can afford that much acreage. Guys, you know, move down to Florida, and, you know, those are where the big guns are. They got towers all over the place, and it's something to dream about. But, you know, I don't know, even if push came to shove, I could quite spend the amount of money that some of those guys do to kind of build their own little contest station. But, you know, whatever works. I know people who get out with a quarter-wave radial, you know, mag mount type of a thing, kind of stuck on their refrigerator. That's what they're using to be their counterpoise. And whatever works. If you get out, great. You know, if you can't get out, then you got to kind of think a little bit cleverer. But seems like you got everything, and you're not particularly greedy, which is important. You know, a lot of people, unfortunately, they want all the bands all the time, and, you know, Mother Nature always has a price to be paid. Any other comments out there on this subject? Hit that push to talk.
Thanks, Roy, for exploring this. I appreciate it. It was a good conversation. KD2VHD, back to that.
You're welcome, Jim. We're always looking for interesting topics, and I appreciate everyone's help and additions to this topic. Jeff, you want to say something?
Yeah, thank you, Roy. Just the previous, maybe I'm being pedantic, but the previous comment was that everything was balanced, and if you're feeding something with coax, I'm not sure that you can call it balanced. I think that you have to have a balun in there in order to make a balanced QSL.
Comment
on that. Yes, I have a balanced, basically I wind them on, you know, type 31, type 52, these different types of ferrite material, toroids. And, the SWR is great. I mean, one great way of really getting the SWR really low is use very lossy cable. That's a joke. I'm just kidding. But you're absolutely right about that. If I would try to, you know, just connect the coax directly to, you know, a half wave split in half to quarter wave lengths of wire, even if it was perfectly resonant, there'd be an awful lot of common mode running on that coax back to the rig. I prefer not to have all that RF right in my face, so I use the unknowns, balance, whatever. So, thanks for your comment. 82KJ, back to that. Thank you.
AC2PL. Yeah, I think people would benefit from your knowledge and your engineering, which is kind of why I made a very specific comment. People here like to hear about the specific engineering of antennas and how people, especially with your experience, make them work perfectly and give a flat SWR. Anyway, AC2PL, back to Matt. Thank you.
Okie doke. Have we finished this topic? If anyone has any further comments to make, feel free. Okay, on to the next. Brian, you have a question or a comment or a topic for us tonight? Yeah, Brian occasionally steps away from the radio, so we'll shuffle our decks and get back to him after Alex. Alex, are you still with us?
I am. So I am being told to purchase Christmas lights for my house, and we're looking at Halloween and Christmas decorations. Is there anything I can do to not have them be noisy and horrible? Like, do a certain type of Christmas light better, or do I need to just put, would a toroid work on them? Or is there anything to minimize the negative impact on the radio spectrum? In the stage before purchasing, AD2DU.
Yeah, I would kind of hate to get to the point where I have to toroid a bunch of Christmas lights. You know, I mean, I think it's partially doable, but not satisfying. I would probably avail yourself of the wisdom of forums, Reddits, and what have you, because I am sure there must have been conversation on this topic on the specific models and manufacturers either upvoted or downvoted. Have you considered checking those places?
I haven't yet. I didn't know if there were any sort of broad stroke advice before I get to the individual stage, but I may just skip right to that. You may be correct.
Yeah, because unfortunately it's not like anyone gives you the schematics of their design and you know, the how hard they tested it. It's a very haphazard. They're all made in China at this point. So, you know, it's an opaque environment. A lot of the Chinese stuff that I occasionally buy, I double-check on the Internet to see if someone's screaming bloody murder. And there are Chinese manufacturers of home device controls that they are yelling and screaming about how they're designed to basically only work with their own equipment and no one else's, even though they use universal standards. So it's always good to double-check with the Internet. Reddit can be annoying. I've been insulted numerous times by people in Reddit. They tend to have an attitude problem, but there are other forums available where the guys are much more pleasant.
Now, hopefully one of the YouTube people who get Amazon affiliate referrals will actually just order and test them and make some sort of video. But thank you very much, Russ. 82 to you.
Go on.
Yes, Paul?
The only problem I ever had with my older radio, I don't know if the new one would have a problem, but the only problem I had was blinking lights, you know, many years ago. And I said, that's it. I took that strain out, and then I never had another problem after that. And I had a combination of the old-fashioned lights and the LEDs, and it was only the blinkers that really gave me problems. Back to you, Roy.
The real problem I found is when you have some of the bulbs were old LEDs that had a flicker rate that was too low. Some people don't see flicker. Some people see flicker out of the peripheral vision. And, you know, the original early model LEDs were just above that for most people, but not everyone. And the absolute worst, is to combine a flickering LED with a flickering fluorescent, because they usually never had the same time standard. So they burned my eyes out when I had them both on simultaneously. My nephew had that situation where the fluorescent display in his laptop didn't coincide with the LED in his fixture, and it was just it was mind-numbing. It was a terrible experience. Thankfully, I haven't heard anything like that in years. They solved it by increasing the refresh rate on the LEDs. Yes, Jeff.
I don't know if I'm understanding the question. If it's a matter of interference in the shack or interference going one way or the other way, I can't quite suss it out. I have a small video or several videos on my QRZ page, which what Lee links to, where I'm looking for RFA immediately in my shack, and I find it in a bunch of different places in the near field. There's that word again, near field. But it comes from fluorescent lights and LEDs and displays and all that. I'm not sure if the original question is whether the lights interfere with the shack or the shack interferes with the lights. Give us help.
Well, I was making the assumption of the LEDs give interference at radio frequencies. So I kind of decided on my own. Alex, is there any particular direction you're most interested in, or both directions?
Oh, Roy's correct. I definitely care more about the lights affecting the radio. It hadn't occurred to me that the radio would affect the lights. That's a good point, that I was not concerned about that aspect of it.
Okay. Well, yeah, Jeff has a good idea to just go YouTube. I have my own little foibles with YouTube. I find that, unfortunately, amateur radio YouTubes have a signal-to-noise ratio of about 50%, And I find forums to be a little bit better that way. So there seems to be a group of people on YouTube who give answers to questions that they seemingly have no clue what the question or the answer meant. So I'm not quite sure what's going on there psychologically, but there definitely is some situation going on among some YouTubers.
U.S.
Yes, Paul?
Another problem, again, many years ago. If I transmitted high power in those days, it was 30 watts instead of 5 watts. Neighbors spot. So every time I heat up, I looked out the window, I said, his lights are on. That's odd. And then I put two and two together. But if I went 5 watts, that wouldn't happen. So, you know, some people's electronic switching gadgets, well, maybe they worked on it over the years. Maybe they don't have that problem anymore. Just a couple of decades ago. That was very interesting. But you never found out it was me. Back to you.
Well, that's good. Yeah, who knows what, but over the years they've raised the refresh rate, so people aren't complaining of the flicker, and they've improved the heat, carrying the heat away so the units... In the old days, if you put it in a wrong position, it would overheat and its life expectancy would be very shortened. So they've done a lot better with heat shields, they've done a lot better with RF shielding, and they've done a lot better with the electronics and the refresh rate. So, and they've kept the prices down. So things are looking up for LEDs. Even though you can still buy incandescents, there are some things that you just need incandescents. I have an incandescent light bulb in my oven, because as far as I'm aware, I don't know of any LED bulb that can survive an oven. So I'm thankful that, although it costs more money, because oven incandescent bulbs go out a lot faster than LEDs.
KJ?
Yes, Bruce?
I had a very interesting thing here. So on 70 centimeter primarily, I noticed that every time I would basically unkey the mic, like if I was speaking and then I would just let go of the push to talk, I would hear this funny sound. I figured it was something with the radio, whatever. It turned out that that because my stuff's in the attic, I had one of the smoke alarms. They're all wired together, you know, with that third wire, so that if one goes off, they all go off. And that one was right near the base of one of the J-poles. And when I let go, I would hear this chirp. And I was thinking, well, now I'll move the J-pole or something like that. But what I wound up doing was putting some ferrite beads right on the power wires, right, in, you know, that were going to the smoke detector. And that was the end of it. But that kind of... That was rather strange. I was like, where's the sound coming from? Anyway, 82KJ, back to you.
AC2GS. Yeah, thankfully there's fewer reports of equipment that misfired when exposed to relatively mild levels of radio waves. You know, people were telling me all kinds of horror stories when they were growing up and trying to hide from their neighbors. With the exception of a couple of little flaky things with computers in my shack when I run relatively higher power than usual, I haven't had too many serious problems that way. But, yeah, and they can be kind of devilish to go and figure out, especially if they occur outside of the shack environment, and you're just kind of going by little strange noises that you're hearing being transmitted, you know, conducting down to some wall or someplace. Let's see if Brian is back. Brian, are you out there? All I guess he's still away. Well, we still have a little time. If anyone has any questions or topics or comments to make, feel free, hit that push to talk.
K2HO, push to check in, no traffic.
Okie doke. Anyone have any questions, comments, or topics for tonight? Hit that push to talk.
VHD.
Yes, Jim.
So, on the AI thing, briefly, I think you've heard me say many times it's fake intelligence, and we should disregard it. I happen to be thinking that it's the modern day circus. And it's just as enjoyable as the crazy circus of 100 years ago. I'm getting a kick out of it. I don't know what you feel about that, but that's my feeling.
Well, I'm glad you're getting a kick out of it. You know, the people who end up going psychotic because they're foolishly using this system to be their synthetic analyst. And the problem, as I've mentioned repeatedly from the very beginning of my first interaction with ChatGPT, it's fundamentally not designed to be correct. It's fundamentally designed to be accepted, to kind of like the synthetic personality. It's very agreeable. It's very supportive. And that's why people are getting into such terrible problems. They're discussing their life and times problems with a machine that doesn't have the faintest clue what you're talking about, but knows the word combinations that will make you feel temporarily happy. So they'll agree with you about anything, whether that your wife is trying to kill you, or your mother is trying to kill you, or some other paranoid ideation. And there's been more than a few guys end up in the loony bin because of that. You know, some of them actually shot their relatives or their wives or what have you because of that annoying feedback loop that ChatGPT and others supply to gullible people. So it's dangerous. It'll be, we differ somewhat slightly. I don't think when the bubble bursts, all of this will disappear. I think it's a lot like the dot-com bubble. Billions of dollars of value went up in flames. A lot of businesses died and were never reborn. But when the push comes to shove, there was still the dot-coms, there was still the Internet, and we use it even more these days than back then. So I think there will be some pseudo-AI going on after the bubble bursts. I don't believe in generative AI as a means to building a super genius who will rule the universe. I think smart IT guys don't know everything, and this they got it really wrong this time with the idea that if you just go up that curve, there is no wall, there's no slope going down, it always goes up. You know, it's like turtles all the way down. So I think there will be a benefit of this AI boom and crash. It simply won't be the one that all these guys who have billions of dollars invested in it think it is.
Interesting thoughts. I'm tempted to say I agree with all of them, and I'm pretty closely too. But I think what we're seeing is something much more akin to the Ringling Brothers at Barnum Bailey Circus and the bearded lady and the boy with the fangs and the freakazoids of days past, where they took advantage of actually physical people to do this weird show. Now it's being done digitally, but I think it has a place in humor, in conversation, but it does not have a place in reality because it's not. So there's that. Cool. Back to Roy.
Well, you know, it's a matter of what English means. It exists. We've talked about it before. I don't like calling it artificial intelligence either, because that's not actually a well-defined term. It's sort of whatever you want artificial intelligence to be, which is a terrible way of using words when the meaning is so vague and confusing that it means pretty much nothing. I think there's something there. I think it will be of use in some ways. I don't think it will be universal, and I don't think it counts as geniuses. Again, I agree with you. They're not thinking machines. They do not think. They do not understand what you are saying. They don't understand what they are saying. They are simply taking a bunch of probabilities of how words are connected and taking your prompt as the initial beginning of a paragraph and using those probability tables that they've been generated for them, using copyrighted material that they had no right to, in order to approximate the response and the end of that paragraph. And if they have absolutely nothing to go on, rather than tell you that they have no clue, they will simply make the stuff up, which is problematic, even if it is only, say, 5%. You know, if only 5% of your food is poisoned, that's not acceptable. The same way with artificial intelligence and hallucinations. You pretty much have to get it down to 0.00001% of the time for it to be something that you could depend upon. And right now, it's nowhere near there.
So we would be coming closer to convergence on the hypothesis that it's not really, artificial intelligence. It's fake intelligence. And we treat it like the circus of 100 years ago.
Well, I would be happier, again, if I was a word Nazi, if it was was termed simulated intelligence, because for some people it simulates a reasonably good approximation of intelligence without being intelligent. So, for the most part, we've kind of been on parallel tracks, very close to each other. I mean, I think yours is a little bit more absolute than mine. I give it the benefit of the doubt that, you know, you might be able to use it for something, you know, like a spork. You know, spork is probably not the greatest invention in mankind, but occasionally some people actually like to use a spork.
K2SDP.
Yes, Chris?
Yeah, I agree with you, Roy. We've talked about this before. I wrote quote-unquote AI software 30 years ago. We didn't call it AI. There was no such thing as AI. We just wrote software that learned. So mostly it's nonsense. However, there are some good things about it, and I've also mentioned this before. One is in your field. So, for example, it's task-oriented. It can do a lot of tasks in a hurry, a lot faster than we can. So, for example, reading MRIs. Takes a very long time for radiologists to read an MRI. There's a lot of images. There's a lot to look at. They make mistakes. It's difficult to read. It's up for interpretation. So a bunch of gene scientists or doctors, whatever, fed an AI machine millions of MRIs that they already have the results to. They know which ones ended up bad and which ones ended up good. For example, looking for cancer. And then took a new MRI of a new person that they don't know what if he is positive or negative, and they fed its MRI into the machine, and it immediately tells it whether it's good or bad. And when they go back and take a look at this patient or operate on him, 9 times out of 10 or 90% of the time, the AI was right in reading that MRI. So that's just tasking. It's not really AI. It's taking history and adding it all up and making a decision on it. You want to call it AI? Okay, I just call it, it's doing a bunch of research for you, that's all.
Yeah, Yeah, but they, yeah, I mean, they've been doing that for some time, even before they plugged in generative AI as a method. They found initially they were very optimistic about it, but the later studies tended to demonstrate that these artificial readings tend to generate a lot more false positives, which aren't as bad as false negatives, but they're problematic as well. So I think the jury is still out for things like that, but, you know, algorithms might improve. I mean, the stuff that you worked on had basic algorithms where theoretically you could